The paradox of the Christian life is that God desires a broken and contrite heart. And how do we have a broken and contrite heart? It's by looking very clearly at the core of our being. At the core of our being, we're self-centered, we're depraved, we're perverse, we're hostile toward God.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
You know, Jack, life is just tough. I remember reading a book that I really have loved. It's called The Road Less Traveled. And the first line of that book is three words: life is difficult. And I think that's such a perfect way to begin a book that's got a lot of wisdom in it. Today we're going to continue to talk about what is biblical Christianity and talk about the whole area of sin again and mercy. Sin is one of the things that makes life really tough for us.
Yes, one of the main things.
Yeah. As we're sitting here this morning, there's other things that make it tough. You're having a hard time with your voice, and I ran down here really quickly after having an emergency phone call. But, you know, those things are easy compared to the sinfulness that just fills our whole being and comes out in all our relationships. Lots of people think that once they became a Christian, they don't have that problem or shouldn't have the problem with sinfulness anymore. That becoming a Christian means that we'll have, I think what a lot of people would call a victorious Christian life that really is free of problems.
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest and most important misconceptions about our faith that's abroad today in our culture. I really came to my own as a Christian under teaching that taught the victorious Christian life in a particular form. And it was very beneficial to me. It was very important to me. I got oriented in important directions in my faith by that teaching. But as I have come to understand through my study of the Bible over the years, nonetheless, the whole idea that the result of coming to Christ in this lifetime is that we can transcend our sinfulness and sort of leave that behind and make that no longer a part of our life is a gross misconception and not at all what the Bible is teaching.
You know, you caught my attention there for a minute, Jack. You said that that's the teaching, kind of the victorious Christian life, which means, I think, once you become a Christian, things should really be clearing up, that sin shouldn't be a problem in your life, at least much, much less so, and increasingly less so. You said, though, that that was helpful to you. So if it was helpful to you, why is it that you don't just continue with that teaching, or you don't just continue with that idea if it was something that was good for you?
Well, I think the thing about it that was most helpful to me was making sense out of, or making an integral part of my Christian walk, the desire to even strive against my sinfulness. That was important to me because I'm not sure as a young Christian growing up in a very conservative Christian environment that I had ever really connected striving to be righteous with what it meant to be a disciple of Jesus. There's also a teaching out there, I don't know if it's prevalent today or not, but when I was a child, there was a teaching out there that you came to Jesus for the forgiveness of your sins. So what was important is that you believed in Jesus and you believed the true doctrine that qualified you forgiveness. That's what was really important. And there was a downplaying of any kind of sense of, but of course you wouldn't want to sin anymore. I mean, that was there, but it was certainly de-emphasized in the church culture in which I grew up. So when I came to this other church that was teaching this form of victorious Christian living, at least the emphasis got put in the right place, I think. And that is, you know, the way you started our conversation, sin is the biggest problem in our lives. Sin is a huge bummer in human existence. And dealing with that, transcending that, overcoming that would be the most wonderful blessing that, that any human being could experience. Well, I think that was all a part of what underlay this teaching, and that was a very, very important and right emphasis. It's just that, that they went on to say, there's really no reason in the world, in theory and in principle, why you and I as Christians right now, if we just learn to live this life right, can't live an utterly sinless and morally perfect life. They would go on to say, we don't, of course, because we lack the faith, we lack the maturity of faith and the strength of faith to do it right, to live by faith constantly. And since we fail in our walk of faith, we find sin in our life. But in principle, they would argue, if I would just live the walk of faith consistently 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I would literally live a sinless life.
I think I was under that kind of teaching also. I don't think I was as conscious as you were during that period of my life. I became a Christian in about the middle of my high school years, and I don't know, a lot of it was pretty social. But they were teaching us about breathing in the Spirit, and I think that's what they were meaning, was if you could put Christ at the throne of your life and breathe in the Spirit, I'm not sure if that's exactly the right wording, then I could walk a sinless life. And I just had to figure out how to do it right. And the frustration for me was, I just don't have the key. I just can't quite figure it out. Everybody seems to understand what they're talking about. They're breathing in the Spirit. How come I can't? And I just couldn't figure it out. It was like a math problem is to me. Math is Greek. I don't get it. And I always sat there trying to figure it out and not being able to. And that's the same way I felt about my Christian life. So what I did was I pretended like I was very together, and I think came to believe that I was.
Mm-hmm. For years, as a Bible teacher, I taught a kind of victorious Christian life theology. And inevitably, after teaching, I would have someone come up to me after a class or a sermon or whatever. They would come up to me and say, boy, that was wonderful, that was great, that really makes a lot of sense to me, now I understand. I just have one question. How do you do it?
That would have been my question.
Right.
Though I don't think I would have been as brave to say, how do you do it? And I think the people that are actually saying that, Jack, are really trying to figure it out and really trying to think, because I just hid.
I just hid. Hid.
Uh-huh. I just thought, you know, I can't make this happen, but I'm not going to show anybody else, because I'm looking around and everybody else seems to have gotten what was just said. So, you know, yeah. I'm not going to expose myself here.
And that sense of agreement by the part of a group is a very seductive force that just sucks us in, and we just have to pretend like we know along with everybody else what's going on, even when we don't. It's a very kind of crazy experience. But the point that I'm driving at in all this is that actually the victorious Christian life teaching may take many, many different forms. But I don't care what form we're talking about, the fundamental mistake is the same in all of them. And that is that the Bible is suggesting to me now that God has provided the way whereby I can transcend my sinfulness in this world. That just is not true. It is not what the gospel is. It's not what the Bible is teaching.
That's a pretty radical thing for us to grasp, because when we become Christians, it really is a nice thing to think that we're not going to have to deal with this ugliness of our own sinfulness and the sinfulness around us really anymore, that we really get to, like you said, transcend into another hemisphere, I guess, that makes us live life in a much easier way. I guess that's what it is. We want it to be easier, and we think becoming Christians, it will get easier.
Well, absolutely. And that's what's so attractive about that teaching, is that we're so weary of dealing with ourselves and dealing with our moral brokenness that if someone comes along and says, hey, you don't have to do that anymore, I mean, who wouldn't jump at that? Who of us would not find that attractive? But it's not realistic in the sense that what God is requiring of us instead is to persevere in our faith here and now in this lifetime, struggling with our sin, confronting our own evil and our own sinfulness until we leave this age and and go to the kingdom of God in the age to come. There, we are going to experience that freedom from sin that our heart longs for and that God has ultimately promised.
Life is going to get easier, but it's not going to get easier right now.
Right, exactly. And that's why the New Testament constantly refers to it as a hope before us. It's a hope. And Paul goes out of his way in chapter 8 of Romans to say, this hope that we have, we do not see. If we saw it, we wouldn't call it a hope. It's precisely because we don't see it as a reality that we refer to it as a hope before us.
I remember somewhere hearing that hope was defined as a confident expectation of what was to happen in the future.
Right, exactly. Yeah, a confident and, I would add, eager expectation of something that God has promised will happen. Yeah.
So my eager expectation is that I'm going to be a sinless person in heaven, but that's not at all going to happen to me here and now.
Right.
And I think when I first heard that, Jack, it was a tremendous disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really wanted life, and I do want life now. I am still weary, much more weary than I used to be, even, of my own sinfulness. And I'd like it to be that I was transformed into something different today, in the sense that I wasn't sinful.
Right.
I want that victorious Christian life today.
Sure. But let's keep it in perspective. You would probably also like to live a life without disease, without any sort of physical problems or material problems. We would all like that as well. But realistically, is that what God has promised us? Some Bible teachers even tell us, yeah, God has promised that. But that is just as much a deception. That is not what the gospel is all about.
Yeah, what a contrast to what we want. What we want is exactly what you said. I was kind of getting a picture in my mind, Jack, of not having any financial problems or hassles, not having any taxes, not having any problems that are physical in nature. And as my body grows older, I certainly see that more and more. I'd like to not have to look forward to the death of myself or the people that I love. I don't like the decay around me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like the sinfulness inside of me. So I really want all of that today. And it's nice to think, when I used to think, that the Bible was going to help me get rid of all that stuff. But we're saying kind of a radical message to the victorious Christian life message. And the one that you and I both have very much embraced in the past, to saying that here we are in kind of a hopeless state of sinfulness apart from the mercy of God.
Yes, exactly. In past weeks we were talking about God's judgment and the judgment seat against human sin. And the picture that the Bible presents is that we are so thoroughly and completely people in rebellion against God, haters of God, enemies of God, and we are enslaved to our own rebellion and our own hostility to God, so much so that we could never free ourselves from it. I mean, in the very process of trying to be religious and pious and spiritual people, we end up tainting everything that we do with really a kind of self-centered rebellion against God. And so there's no way in the world that we could ever live lives that commend ourselves to God. We're not. Our lives will always reek of this hostility and rebellion and this immorality and this perversity and this depravity that marks us so severely. And so when Paul is describing that in the book of Romans, his whole purpose is to say, look, no way in the world am I ever going to live a life that will make me worthy of this promised kingdom in the future, this life that God has promised in the future. There's no way that I could ever go before the judgment seat and say, God, I commend myself to you and your kingdom on the basis of my life. I just think if you take a good look at my life, you'll see that I'm worthy to be here. Not a single soul in the world will be able to make a case like that.
And Paul was very clear about that.
I think so, just crystal clear about that.
And the words that you used, I jotted them down really quickly, are we as Christians, I think is what you're talking about, are still depraved. We're still perverse. We're in self-centered rebellion against God. Now, those are words, those are phrases that aren't typically used to describe a Christian. Can you help us understand how you can use those words to describe a Christian, and what then does the Christian have no hope of any kind of transformation in our life here and now?
Okay. Well, we'll have to talk about this in the future in more detail, but just to briefly answer that, I'm not suggesting that Christians are not significantly different than non-Christians. That the Bible doesn't hesitate to call the Christian believer a righteous person and the unbeliever a sinner. That contrast between the righteous and the sinners is pretty prevalent in the Bible, particularly the Old Testament. In the New Testament, you find the distinction between a child of God and a child of the devil. That distinction is pretty important in the New Testament.
So I can be righteous and still be depraved, perverse, and self-centered,
precisely,
rebellion.
Precisely. That's the key to understanding the New Testament, is to understand that we need to talk about our life experience at two different levels. On the one hand, if we look at my most basic, my most foundational moral character and moral nature, then those adjectives apply to me. I am basically and fundamentally depraved, broken, perverse, in rebellion against God, a hater of God, hostile to Him. And we see that in all kinds of ways. Look at my actions in unguarded moments, for example. The way I respond defensively and sarcastically, impatiently, unlovingly, uncaringly, how I am unthinkingly cruel to people. If I have time to pause and reflect, do I want to say that or not? Sometimes I can guard my heart and guard my tongue and not say that nasty thing. But in an unguarded moment, look at all the stuff that comes out of me, the stuff that is cruel and selfish and proud and just evil in many, many different ways. Where is that coming from? It's coming from the depths of what is most profoundly me. My fundamental nature. At that level, even we as Christians don't get cleaned up when we become Christians. That doesn't get fixed yet. It's going to get fixed, but it doesn't get fixed yet. And that's why, as Christians, we're capable of incredibly horrendous thoughts, attitudes, deeds, because it's all there. It's there, ready to come out if we let it out. However, there are two kinds of people that are fundamentally depraved at that level. There are people who are not only sinful and evil in their moral nature, but, to use a word the Bible would use, their hearts are also hardened against God. Their hearts are in rebellion against God. Their hearts are deceived, full of delusion, full of deceit. To quote a psalm, our hearts are deceitful. Those people are not only evil, but they in one way or another glory in their own evil, or if they don't go so far as to glory in their own evil, at least they rationalize it and defend it, deny it, stonewall any accusations. I mean, we just refuse to see ourselves, refuse to allow ourselves to acknowledge the sin and evil that's really there. That's one kind of heart. That's the heart of what the Bible would call a sinner. The heart of a righteous man or woman is the heart of a person who, although he or she is evil, they look at their own heart and they acknowledge the evil, and they respond to it by turning to God and saying, God, save me. God, I am evil. Save me. Have mercy upon me. I don't want to be what I am. I don't want to remain here. I don't want to stay the person that I am. I would love to be fixed. I would love to be a person who reflects your character in everything that I think, in everything that I do, in everything that I say. Well, that's a fundamentally different kind of heart, and that's what's distinctively different. In a nutshell, that's what's distinctively different about the believer.
What you're saying then is that the difference between a believer and a non-believer isn't that our hearts are different, essentially. We both have equally perverse hearts that, would you say, are evil, that hate God, that are in rebellion. As a believer, what I want to do is look at my heart and call it what it is. Not say, hey, I am doing evil things, thinking evil things, believing evil things, and that's okay with me. But I look at my heart and say, I don't like that. And I work really hard to not make that a part of my life.
Yeah, we could put it that way. What you mean by heart when you say that is just the very foundational core of my being, I assume. And yes. And yes, that is what I was saying. What's a little bit confusing is I think the way the New Testament uses the word heart, however, is not to describe that foundational core of my being, but rather to describe something less foundational, something that's still essential to who I am, but less foundational than my moral core. And that's what it calls the heart. The term that I like, that has helped me a lot, I get from a Danish philosopher, Søren Kierkegaard. He calls it our subjectivity.
He calls our heart our subjectivity?
Yes, this thing that is different about the believer from the unbeliever. And I think that's what the New Testament is calling our heart.
Okay.
And by subjectivity, he means the desires that are important to us, the attitudes and perceptions and beliefs that define us. It's real basic. It is real foundational to who I am. But there's something even more foundational than my desires and my beliefs and my perceptions and my attitudes of my heart, and that is the very moral core of my being itself.
Okay,
and it's that more basic thing that doesn't get touched by God in this lifetime. That remains perverse and depraved and capable of anything.
So it's like there's two levels that you're talking about.
Precisely.
At one level, which is the core, the very bottom, is perverse and evil. We're haters of God. We're broken. We're in rebellion against God. That's the same between believers and unbelievers, that core, bottom level.
Right.
But then if you go, so to speak, a level up, there's the heart, which Kierkegaard calls the subjectivity. And that's where we're different. The non-believers and believers are different. The believers have a heart that's softening toward God. Unbelievers are hardened toward God.
Yeah.
And the way that looks in our life is, over time, when I'm in a relationship with somebody and I realize that I have been hurtful, for example, I will perhaps acknowledge that hurtfulness, because I won't be saying, it's okay to be sinful, it's okay to just have hurt you. I'll know that it isn't okay, and I won't want that to be a part of my life.
Right, precisely. In contrast to the hard heart that always wants to deflect blame to somebody else and elsewhere and away from myself, not own it, not acknowledge it, or at the height of our perversity, even to somehow take pride in the fact that I'm a real ruthless person, and I glory and wallow in my ruthlessness, for example.
I'm proud of it.
I'm proud of it, yeah. I mean, that's sort of the height of perversity.
Yeah. I revel in it. I think it's good. I'm proud of the power that it gives me.
Yeah. But it's that tenderness toward what's good and true and right and loving and compassionate and merciful, and we could go on. It's that openness and tenderness toward that marks the subjectivity or the heart of a true believer, of a child of God.
Jack, let's talk a little bit more about what that might look like, that tenderness look like in the heart of a believer.
Well, let me not answer that now, because I think in the future we want to look at in greater detail just several dozen characteristics, I think, that would characterize the child of God. And I don't know that we have time right now in this program to do that, but in the future let's look at that in detail.
Yeah, I think that's really important, because people are probably looking at themselves and saying, okay, am I a believer or am I not?
Yeah.
And that's really a huge question for so many people. Am I a Christian or am I not? Do I have saving faith? And it really is very, very difficult for some people on a daily basis to wonder, are they saved or not? It's great that we have eternal security, they would say, but am I even a believer? And I don't really know. It's very confusing to know. I remember sitting for years and years and years in churches and really not knowing if I was a believer or not. So
yeah.
So this question we will address, and it's very, very important.
Yeah, in the meantime, I could highly recommend a book that has just now come from the printer that a colleague of mine has written, called Righteous Sinners by Ron Julian. And that's exactly the topic of his book, is to help people with that question, how do I sort out and evaluate my own life with respect to am I or am I not a man or woman of faith based on the same sort of criteria that we're going to be talking about.
I bet that's a great book.
Yeah, I'm about halfway through. I think it is very great.
Just really timely, really important to a lot of people.
Over the years, the teachers of McKinsey Study Center have offered many classes, from studies in the book of Romans and Revelation, to a biblical view of history and culture, to sexuality and relationships. McKinsey has also presented conferences ranging on topics such as education, evolution, and the arts. Most of the lectures and discussions are available on tape and can be purchased for a modest fee. McKinsey also has a tape catalog to help you make your choosing easier. To order tapes or get a copy of the catalog, call McKinsey at 541-485-4801. Now, here again are Jack and Christine.
So, Jack, I think what we're saying is that at the core of our being, at that first bottom level, we really are in a hopeless position. It isn't our next core, our heart, that's going to get us salvation. It seems to me, if we have this core that is so perverse.
Precisely. That's critical to understanding so much of what's being talked about in the New Testament, is that the issue is, am I worthy to be granted a place in the kingdom of God, eternal life in the kingdom of God, or not? And what the apostles insist on is that the only thing that would make us worthy to be there would be if at the most basic foundational core of my being, I were godly, I were a genuinely good person
at that core level.
Anything short of that makes me a broken, valueless to God individual creature. I'm just a broken creature. And I really don't belong in his kingdom. I don't deserve to be in his kingdom. There's absolutely nothing about me to commend myself to him. So if I'm going to be there at all, it's not going to be enough even that I have a heart that is learning to love God and striving to know him and is hungering and thirsting after righteousness. Even that does not make me worthy of the kingdom of God. If I'm going to get there at all, it's only going to be because God decides to show me mercy and say, you don't belong here, but I'm going to give you an inheritance here anyway. And I'm going to recreate you and make you fit for make you the appropriate kind of creature to belong to that kingdom. But I don't give you a place there because you deserve it. I give you a place there because it's an act of mercy on my part. We really have to come to terms with that. If we don't understand that, then there's very little about Christianity that we're going to understand.
So to put it bluntly, God says, I'm really not going to clean you up here. I want you to see how dirty you are. And when we get to heaven, that's where I'm going to do the cleanup job.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's right. So in the meantime, I simply have to get my mind and my heart around the fact that God is a merciful God who has promised me, out of his mercy, a place there anyway, even though I am filthy at the core of my being. And that's a hard one for us to come to terms with. I mean, there's a sort of pride that runs deep in us that kind of balks at that and rebels at that. I mean, we're constantly running away from reality into these little fantasy worlds that we would prefer to live in. And one of those fantasy worlds that we'd prefer to live in is envisioning ourselves going before the judgment seat of God and God saying, yeah, you're worthy. You're really a good person. And that's why I would like you to be in my kingdom. It offends us that we would get to the judgment seat of Christ or to God's judgment seat and have for it to be the case that God shows us mercy. We don't want to be there on the basis of mercy. We want to be there on the basis of worthiness. And we just so rebel against the notion that we are not worthy, that there are people who are going to go to their eternal condemnation refusing to receive the mercy of God and accept the mercy of God because they would have rather have been worthy. And they spend their life pretending that they are worthy and never acknowledging their unworthiness.
You know, you're right. It's very, very difficult to recognize our unworthiness as a concept. I can believe it. It's much easier as a concept that I'm a sinner, that at the core of my being I'm a very hurtful person that is rebellious. But, you know, even as I say the word rebellious, I think of, you know, a little kid that's just kicking his feet and saying no, or, you know, something very, very obvious. And I'm much more refined than that. I don't usually, at least, kick my feet and yell no and, you know, clench my fist to God. Not usually. I'm pretty cleaned up on the outside. I look pretty good to myself and pretty good to other people. And so that kind of cleanup job is really alluring. It's really seductive for me to think, you know, I really am doing pretty good here. And I think what's important to remember is that although my heart may be doing better, I may be wanting more that's good and pursuing more than that's good, at the core of my being, I'm really sloppy.
Yeah, yeah. One of the descriptions Jesus gave of the Pharisees is that they were whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones.
Ouch.
Yeah, ouch is right. It's just nothing but death on the inside, but they had cleaned up the outside to make themselves look spit-shined and wonderful on the outside. And that's what we do. I mean, that in our pride, we clean up the outside and hope desperately that God won't notice the inside. You know, God, look at my outside. But we are just completely fooling ourselves if we think that we have fooled God. The God who peers into the very heart of my being, into the very core of my being, knows exactly all the darkness that's there. And the thing that makes a believer, the thing that makes a child of God, is that we have allowed God to give us a glimpse of our deep down insides as well. We've seen it for the darkness and the blackness that it is, and we have acknowledged that to God and said, God, there's no way that I'm worthy. All I can hope in is your mercy.
But Jack, it seems like the Christian life is an acknowledgement and re-acknowledgement and over-acknowledgement and acknowledgement again of that reality of our hearts, that we, at the core of our being, are really hurtful, broken people. It's not something that just, I think you would agree, happens once.
Yeah, I don't think it happens once, although I do think that there comes a point in my life where it happens decisively. That is, there comes a point where I have finally laid aside my pride enough to stop resisting seeing it, to stop my active resistance against it, which is not to say that I don't balk at it in the future, but I have stopped my commitment against the truth, and I now have a commitment for the truth. And so it gets easier and easier to acknowledge it because I'm not fighting it.
Yeah, I'd go with you there. It's kind of like a giving in finally to the reality of who I am. And once I've given in to that, it's much easier for me to see it the next time and the next time.
Right.
And yet, it's never easy.
No, we always balk.
we always balk. You know, as we're talking here, I'm thinking about people that I work with. And people who are very, very well cleaned out on the outside. I've typically worked in my counseling with people who, I guess quite honestly, can afford counseling. And so they're people who have been, you know, lots of white-collar workers, lots of people who we would see as very cleaned up in our culture, very, very much professionals, and who come in and want are saying their lives are not working, and yet everybody on the outside says they are, and they're making plenty of money, and they're dressing well, and they're driving the right cars, and they have the right house, and they have social skills, and so in many, many ways they just look so very together and so very clean, and they're perhaps even leaders in their church and maybe been Christians for a long time. So you can see the picture I'm drawing, and they come in and start taking off. They want to take off layer after layer of this outside whitewashed appearance. And that is so courageous of people to want. And I think it's got to be a work of God, because there's nothing in their lives that would make them want to do this other than the piercing eye of God saying, I want you for mine. and they start unlayering these cores of themselves. And what happens to them, of course, is their whole life gets splattered out in front of them. All of a sudden, this, you can imagine this person that felt so upright and did it all right, all of a sudden they dig down to the core of their being and they're seeing themselves. All of a sudden they're just kind of splayed out and kind of a mess, and it feels like they've really gone backwards. And the reality is, on the outside it looks like they've gone backwards, but on the inside, because of a much greater commitment to seeing who they really are, they're going forward.
Yeah. What you're suggesting is that a lot of the shining up of the outside, as much as we might think that we do that for other people, is as much, if not more, for ourselves than it is for other people. It's so that we can tell ourselves a lie about ourselves.
Oh, it is. And the thing is, it's hard not to see it.
Yeah.
It's hard not to see that it's... How, I wouldn't get this right. It's easy to believe our own lie.
Right.
Is where I'm trying to say. And people really do. They're not thinking that they're trying to cover up very often. They just have so well. They've just taken up so much of the culture's cues of how to do it that they really feel like that's what's going on. So, again, I really see it as a work of God for people to even come to see what they have so covered up so well. And, of course, that wouldn't happen apart from people really looking at the dynamics of their own life in a very pretty decisive way. They can't just say in a general way, I guess I'm a sinner, but they have to really do some, I think this has become a dirty word in our Christian culture, but do some introspection in terms of looking at who they really are, because all their covers make them not see it.
Right, right.
And I'm saying they, and I think that's an incorrect way to be talking about this. It's not just they, it's me. I have to really work at looking at the sinfulness in my life, even though I've finally given in to, oh yeah, that's who I am. I have to keep, you know, working at not whitewashing my outside and keep looking at my true moral character.
Mm-hmm. But I imagine you see in your practice as well, I certainly see this among the people who come and study the Bible with me, I imagine you see people who will go partway down that road, begin to see the darkness inside, and then refuse to go any further. And they veer away, and they fortify their external trappings of success and righteousness and goodness and refuse to do the work of taking a good look at themselves.
Oh, and it absolutely kills me. Yeah. And those are people that hate me. They think I've ruined their life then.
Absolutely.
Because
yeah. They
had it so well covered. Their whitewash was so kind of perfect. It was so clean. I think of, you know, you paint oil paint on a door, and if you do it really perfectly, you don't even see the lines. So they've done it so well that when they come in and see me, we start looking at the who they are, and they just hate me because they've got some cracks in their paint now. I just am so sad when they leave. But you know what's amazing? Up to this point in my practice, that has been really the minority of people.
That's wonderful.
And you know why I think that's true is just because God happens to be using me in this way now. I think it could change tomorrow. But that just, God happens to be bringing those people into my practice. And they're wanting to grow. They're wanting to take up their cross, die to themselves. Mm-hmm. Such a great cost.
Well, what you've just described is a good way of describing the difference that we were talking about earlier between a child of God and a child of the devil. It's not the only difference, and we'll talk about a lot more differences as we go along, but just to give people a feel for what we're talking about, as you said, all of us could describe a horrendous brokenness inside and horrendous perversion inside. All of us are the same in that regard. But some people, as painful as it is, and as difficult as it is, and as much as we hesitate and balk and fight it, nonetheless, willingly go there as God leads us to take a look at ourselves, and He rubs our nose in our own sin, and we raise our heads and finally say, God, I am terrible, forgive me, have mercy on me. Some of us end up going there because we let God take us there. Others stubbornly refuse to go there and will not go there to the end of their day.
Just dig their heels in,
right,
and clench their fist and hold their jaw,
yeah,
and say, no, I won't see this reality about myself.
I prefer my lie to this reality, and I am not going to believe reality. I'm going to believe my lie. Of course, they don't phrase it that way. Their lie, they insist, is reality.
Okay, Jack, I can just imagine, again, I'm thinking about our listeners and thinking, my heavens. They might be saying, why would God want to rub our nose in our sin? Why would God want us to see this core of our being that's so perverse? Why? You know, you guys are morose.
Well, of course, ultimately, the why of that is hidden in the mystery of God's own counsel and in the mystery of God's own purposes that none of us have access to. It's a lot like the question, why did God create anything at all? Why did God create a world that has evil in it? I mean, if we could answer those questions, then we could answer, why is God taking people like us who are sinners and sanctifying us by bringing us face to face with our own sinfulness? I don't know exactly why, but we have a picture of God consistently throughout the Bible as a God who's bringing light out of darkness, as a God who's starting with nothing and making something, as a God who's taking chaos and ordering it and bringing beauty and purpose and meaning out of something that was just nothing. I mean, from verse 1 in Genesis, where we start with there was nothing but complete vacuity and chaos and disorder, utter, complete blackness and nothingness, and God created a world that he put together. Well, that's just an image of what drives God, what motivates God from beginning to end in this whole thing, is he's going to start with a wreck of a person like me and redeem me and make me into a glorious creature who's prepared to live eternally in a righteous kingdom. That's the God we're dealing with, is a God who redeems, a God who fixes, a God who brings light out of darkness.
That's just the way he's done it.
Yeah.
And we've got to see our darkness to understand and appreciate and want the light.
Exactly.
And that's, it is in our seeing our sinfulness that we're really redeemed.
Right.
It can't be apart from that. That's the way God set it up. You're saying you're not really sure that why God set it up that way, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And apart from seeing our sin, we're not going to understand our need, and we're really not going to, in a real way, head toward God and, paradoxically, find life, find freedom, find God's love, understand God's mercy, see his grace. Those gifts are cheap if we don't get our sinfulness.
Right. And therefore, it is precisely a part of the mercy of God that he takes my hand, he takes my face between his hands and forces me to stare into the pit of my own sinfulness. It, you know, it feels so ruthless. It feels so cruel. It feels so unloving of him to make me see it, you know, to make me acknowledge it. But it's in seeing my sin that I receive his mercy. It's in seeing my darkness that I can be turned toward the light, as you said. So he's really doing me a tremendous favor when he invades my life and lays me bare and exposes me to myself and maybe even other people, and I am forced to just acknowledge who it is that I am. That's the first step toward the kingdom of heaven.
And let's not say that that's easy when God does it to us. We don't all of a sudden feel good. We don't all of a sudden feel his mercy or his grace. Many times it takes a long time before we kind of come up and see the light,
mm-hmm.
so
yeah.
to speak. And Jack, I think another thing that we need to put in here is that when we see our sinfulness, very often that is combined with the hurt that other people have caused us, have sinned against us. And so we get that very confused often, that there is this sinfulness at the core of our being, and God loves us nonetheless. But when people have seen the sinfulness at the core of our being, or out of their own sinfulness, they have damaged us, it becomes a pretty formidable task to be able to see our sin as opposed to our faults, as opposed to maybe not even our faults, but the things that people have said about us that are hurtful.
Can you think of an example?
Well, you asked me for an example, and I should be able to come up with 10,000 of them right off the bat, because I work with it all the time, but I'm kind of having a hard time with an example. So I'll use an example in my own life. There's a person in my life who very early treated me as though I was very despicable, would find things wrong about me and glory in them, want to find them and dig them in. And so I became very adept at wanting not to see or not to show those things about myself, because I would be found despicable, trashed, thrown away, laughed at. They would be glad. They would glory in, they'd revel in having found that out about me and pointed out to me. Well, it makes it very difficult then to see my own sinfulness, because I have been so hurt by somebody using that as a way to hurt me. So I need to be able to separate that I am a person who is unworthy for salvation in God's eyes, that I am a perverse and evil person. It's much more difficult for me to see that cleanly because I've been so hurt by somebody trying to find it in me and hurt me by it.
Because they were unmerciful toward your failings.
That's right. Yeah. Which is different than God's mercy.
Right.
I expect, and I think most people expect, not to have mercy.
Yeah. Now, that's an excellent point, is that the two go hand in hand. We can't very well freely acknowledge my own unworthiness if I don't know and understand that I will be met by God with mercy. Those two have to go hand in hand, and I have to see them at the same time. I have to see the mercy of God and understand that God will be merciful in order to logically to be able to be open and honest about my sinfulness. But of course, I can't really appreciate and understand the mercy of God unless I am open and honest about my sinfulness. I mean, I don't even need mercy if I'm not a sinner.
Right.
So the two really go hand in hand, and it's important to see them together.
And it's kind of a dance that's difficult to dance, because on one hand, if somebody like me doesn't expect mercy, and yet, so it's hard for me to look at my sin, I'll just want to keep covering it up, but I keep covering it up, and then I never see God's mercy.
Right.
So it really does take God's intervention to help us see.
Yeah.
For those of us who have been hurt by the lack of mercy, the hurtfulness of other people. And that's most of us, Jack.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. That it really, in the end, it's a miracle that any of us ever come to acknowledge that God is a merciful God and recognize that and count on that and at the same time see our sinfulness, because it's such a vicious circle that it was impossible for us to kind of navigate and break into.
Yes.
God just needs to turn the light on and we see. And I don't necessarily mean instantaneously. It can happen over the course of months and years, but he has to be turning the light on, or we're just not going to see it.
So let me put a plug in for counseling then. I think counseling done well is being a person who is, the counselor is a person who extends mercy to other people in the face of seeing the depth of that person's sin. And I think a counselor doing their job rightly is a mercy giver.
Be an advocate for God.
Yeah, it might be the first person that somebody has at one time both seen their sin and experienced mercy. That's a gift to give to somebody. I'm sure you as a Bible teacher must do that often.
And ideally, the church would be a whole community of people who would do that, ideally.
Ideally, the pastors and the counselors would be put out of a job in this respect, because we offer mercy to each other.
Right.
But that idea will never happen.
Because of that sin problem that we were talking
about.
Because
of that sin problem at the very core of our being. Right.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
I have a vivid memory of a time when I got a deep, deep splinter in my foot. And I remember that I almost couldn't see because of the pain. I'm not sure why it affected my vision, but I just remember I have this vivid memory of not really being able to see all that well, blurry vision. Maybe it was just because my glasses were off, but my father had me on his lap on the couch, or my foot on his lap, taking the splinter out, and it was so painful as he dug in with his needle into my tender toe to get the thing out, that I just was filled with kind of rage against him, that he was hurting me. And it seems to me that that's exactly the kind of situation that we're all in with respect to God. God has to take us through the incredibly painful process of facing into, admitting, and acknowledge our own sinfulness in order for there to be the healing that we all really want. This splinter has to come out if I'm ever going to find a life, if I'm ever going to see my humanity, my creatureliness fulfilled one day. This splinter of sin has to come out. But the only way it can come out is through a kind of surgery that is going to be very, very painful to me at times. And that's what we've been talking about today, is that this sin that's in us runs so incredibly deep, it's so profound, and it's so real within us, that two things are true. One, we can never on our own ever make ever commend ourselves to God as worthy of being in His kingdom and entering into life. And secondly, it's going to require God to surgically remove it and literally recreate me before it's fixed. That's the point that we were trying to get across, is how deep and profound this problem of sin runs in us.
And we were also saying, Jack, that in understanding this deep and profound sin that runs in us, even as Christians, that it is in understanding that we then get to understand and appreciate and value God's mercy. And it's not apart from understanding our sin that we can really understand the bigness of His mercy. It's a vicious cycle, though, because unless we understand our sin, we won't understand His mercy. But if we don't really expect that God's going to be merciful out of our experience in life of people not being merciful, then we don't want to see our sin. And it really does take an act of God to break into that cycle and to set us free.
And ultimately what he does is he teaches us to respect His character and His response more than we do other people, so that we can be free from the opinions of others.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541 425-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.